When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Sam Bowman is a founding editor of Works in Progress, an online magazine dedicated to sharing new and underrated ideas to improve the world. It features original writing from some of the most interesting thinkers from across the globe. He recently wrote a particularly punchy piece about Britain.
You wrote a pretty major piece in the Sunday Times looking at why Britain has stagnated over the last few years. Can you sum up the piece?
Yeah, I think that pretty much everybody in the UK has the sense that like nothing's working.
Sam and I discussed building an online magazine, where to find the best people, and also how the magazine caught the attention of Stripe, who decided to purchase the company. For those of you that don't know, Stripe is a payments company that was founded by two Irish brothers in 2010 and is now valued at over 50 billion and has processed over £800 billion worth of payments in 2022 alone. Sam, welcome to Jimmy's Jobs of the Future.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a pretty major piece in the Sunday Times looking at why Britain has stagnated over the last few years. Can you sum up the piece?
Yeah, I think that pretty much everybody in the UK and pretty much everybody who's visited the UK recently has the sense that like nothing's working, whether it's public services or crime or the job market or, you know, things being like companies being set up and things like that. And I don't think that's just a kind of post-COVID hangover. I think it's kind of for the last at least 13 years since around the financial crisis. Yeah. There's just this feeling of sclerosis in the UK. And so what I wanted to do was compare the UK to the US. And, you know, we can talk about why I compare it to the US rather than, say, France or Germany, where the UK doesn't end up actually looking quite as bad. But to highlight that by the standards of a middle income or kind of middle class, upper middle class American, their equivalent person in the UK is really badly off, maybe 30%, 40% less rich, much, much less productive, much, much less output in terms of how many days they work and how much they produce. You know, we have this sense that Europeans, including the UK, we've chosen much more leisure time than Americans. And, you know, they work really hard, but like we take time off. And that would actually be a pretty reasonable trade-off. You know, we can debate about whether the France or Germany have struck the exactly the right point there. But, you know, it's not crazy at all to say I'd rather have more time with my kids than more time, more money and more time at work. But the UK doesn't actually do that. You know, by the estimate that I used, Americans could stop working at the end of September, on the 22nd of September, I think was the date I found, and they'd still earn more money than the UK, than Britain's working for the whole year. So it isn't just a kind of leisure time thing. And I am really interested in why that is, because I love the UK. You know, I'm Irish. I moved here when I was 21. I'm a huge fan of the UK, and I think it really could be the best place in the world to live, but I don't think it is right now. And I think the main reason, you know, there are tons and tons, you know, every sclerosis, every economic slowdown has like tons and tons of factors. But I think that the number one problem the UK has is that we just don't build nearly enough of the stuff that we need. So housing is something that I've talked about a lot, I've written about a lot, and I think it's really clear, and maybe we can talk about that a bit later. Infrastructure, you know, everybody who's looking at stuff like the HS2 debate and the Leeds super tram and even Crossrail, and you know, the dream of Crossrail 2, imagine another underground train line. the factor that's common to all of those things is they cost an unbelievable amount of money to build. Yeah. Double or more than double what equivalent projects in Europe usually cost. And that's a really, really big problem. And then the final factor I think is really important is energy, where the price has tripled. The industrial price of energy has tripled over the last 20 years in the UK. And I think that those sort of fundamental factors of the economy are really, really good at explaining the sclerosis that we've had in the rest of the economy. And while that's really depressing, I think the optimistic thing is fixing them might not be as hard as we think.
And so on that, why are we so bad at building things? You know, we led the world in the Industrial Revolution, etc. Like, why is it?
When it comes to housing and to some extent infrastructure and energy, the big problem is what you might call the NIMBY problem, is that we have a system of local permissions that say that it's very easy to stop something from being built, but there's not really a mechanism for you to allow something to be, or you as a local resident to kind of want something to be built. Now, normally when you think about most of the economic interactions you have in your life, they usually involve a good thing and a bad thing. So when you go to the shop, the good thing is you get food or whatever you've bought from the shop. The bad thing is that you give them money. Yeah. And that kind of exchange, when you go to work, the bad thing is you have to go to work. The good thing is you get paid at the end of the month. And that kind of exchange
is even called compensation.
Yeah. This is like we've wrapped up that exchange into most of the things we do in our lives, in our economic lives anyway. But we don't really have that when it comes to getting things built. And I think the core diagnosis is it's really, really, really hard to get permission to build anywhere. Local councils make it really hard. National legislation, specifically the Town and Country Planning Act that we passed in 1947, makes it really hard to build out onto greenfield. Local permissions make it really hard to build up on already developed things or to change change a petrol station into apartments, whatever it might be. And I think the kind of root problem is that it is always a win-lose. It is always, you're a local resident, somebody wants to build something down the road from you. You only really stand to lose from that. There's pretty much nothing that you get from that. And maybe we'll come back to how I think we can make that work. That kind of thing is partially true when it comes to energy infrastructure and physical transport infrastructure. So to give you an example, we have talked for a long time in this country about the onshore wind ban. But there isn't actually an onshore wind ban. There's an onshore wind veto system where local residents and not so local residents, if only one of them objects to an onshore wind project in England and Wales, it doesn't go ahead. If none of them objected, then it would go ahead. It isn't actually literally a ban, but it is effectively a ban because it's a kind of a veto system. Yeah. And similar problems happen for building infrastructure. To give you an example, the Lower Thames Crossing is a proposed tunnel between Kent and Essex. I'm a huge Essex booster, so I love Essex. So I would really, really love for this to be built because Kent's all right as well.
Yeah.
It's had four consultations between 2017 and 2020. Still is no closer to getting built. There are stretches of road that are 17 miles long that have had three consultations. And I think that the consultation approach is a sort of response to this de facto sort of veto approach that we have to stopping things being built. The other factor in all this, as well as this kind of local veto, like vetocracy type system, it's not my term, vetocracy, but I think it's a really elegant way of describing the problem. We also have loads and loads and loads of things like environmental checks and things that by themselves are all really useful. And, it's completely important and legitimate to want a wind or energy project or transport project to be environmentally friendly. But the way we administer them is both really slow, really complicated, and really uncertain. So, there is no way of just saying, okay, we've checked all the boxes, we know for sure, we've had somebody look over this, and we have been given permission for this project to go ahead, and there's no worries after that. That just doesn't happen in the UK. You can continually challenge a project for the entire duration of the project, which creates uncertainty and drives up costs.
And yet, we're still seen as one of the most centralized economies and systems of government in Europe.
So we are in many ways very, very centralized. And, and actually one of the, I think that especially when it comes to housing, we sometimes imagine that the solution is just centralize things more. And, we've got local councils who are, I think a model of thinking about this is Maybe 50 people are affected by building a new house. Maybe all the people on the street that the house is being built on. But 50,000 people, all the people in the local authority area, have the power to object to it, basically. Not literally the power, but they can complain to their local councillor, who can then complain to the planning committee and so on. And so even if you could somehow share the benefits of the new development with those 50 people, there's no way you could possibly do it with the 50,000 people. And so you have this sort of mismatch between who you need to satisfy and who is actually affected by it. My suggestion, and not just mine, but the suggestion that I think is really promising, is rather than centralizing the decision-making to, say, 50 million people in Westminster, devolve the decision-making to, say, 50 people, the people who are most directly affected by the project. And then I think you might be able to get that kind of exchange going, or exchange is for the wrong term, because I don't think you'd really get money changing hands, but you could get a kind of collective decision by people, say, we can all develop on this street.
And one of the interesting examples that you cite in the piece is about France and the fact that actually France, we have a bit of a sort of stereotypical idea of the French people and particularly French business is sort of boozy 2-hour lunches and then they all sort of retire in their late 50s and so on. But actually, like you pointed out some stats in there which shows they're doing quite well on their economy.
Well, the biggest, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the most striking thing is that French people are more productive in terms of how much they produce per hour worked than Brits are. And the only reason that we're roughly level pegging in terms of GDP per capita, which is, you know, how much we produce per person over the year, is because we work much, much more than they do. We have shorter holidays, we have longer working days, we retire later than they do. And so it's kind of an interesting question, right? Like France, by... if you take a really bird's eye view of France, you know, they've got very high taxes. They've got really, really bad approaches to regulation. You know, it's really difficult to fire people. And while that might be attractive if you are in a job, it makes it much harder to get a job because companies are very reluctant to take a risk on you. And there are actually kind of, you know, maybe a side point, but I'm very interested in the economics of immigration. And I'm a big believer in the power of immigration to drive a country's productivity forward and innovation and things like that. France is pretty much the one outlier in terms of new immigrants often are not economically productive or often not a good thing for existing workers. Because I think, and this is really just speculation, the labor market is so much more frozen in time than ours. So they're just much worse at bringing new people in. Anyway, that's a side point. But and yet, despite these high taxes, this really high regulation and so on, the really early pension retirement ages, things like that, France is really productive. So why is that? And I think that the answer is that they can build much more readily than we can. You know, we all know about the French TGV network, and we all know about, you know, the French cities to a much, much smaller level have really good infrastructure like tramways or light rail or whatever it might be. French motorways, you know, France is a bigger country, so it's not shocking that they have more motorways than we do. But they're also much, much more free flowing because they're usually tolled. And they, France, the footprint of Paris, I think has tripled since the Second World War, whereas London's footprint has barely changed at all. So across the board, and lots of the knock-on effects of this are pretty visible too. Like childcare is about half the price in France that it is in the UK. And childcare is affected by how easy is it for people to move to urban areas, how cheap are premises, things like that. One way or another, they can afford it. They can get away with it to a much greater extent than we could because it's so much easier to build.
And the other interesting example, you think of UK and French economies being sort of similar kind of nations, but Poland has had an extraordinary rise over the last three decades, and by some projections will be wealthier than Britain by the end of this decade. Why is that?
Again, well, partly it's because Poland is catching up with the world's advanced economies. You know, I think that this projection that Poland will overtake the UK by the end of the decade in terms of GDP per capita, it would be a really bad outcome for the UK, not because it's inherently bad for Poland to be richer than us, but it would basically require another 10 years or another 7 years of sclerosis. And I really hope that doesn't happen. But it's not just that the UK has flatlined. It's also that Poland has had, especially since joining the European Union, but also prior to that, it's just had this incredible catch-up growth with the world's advanced economies. And this is really, really interesting because among people who talk about growth in the UK, and you know, the origin of this piece that I wrote was a debate with Tyler Cowen and David Edgerton and Diane Coyle, who, in my opinion, you know, they're all brilliant economists. My kind of challenge to them was, you know, are we thinking about growth in the UK in the right way?
Because that was one of the things that really, really struck me in the piece was, and quoting directly here, was we have done nothing to make it easier for people to access the fastest growing industries. And I just thought, gosh, that's such a kind of like statement and a sort of reflection on Britain that you're kind of saying that. I mean, A, what do you think are the most growing industries? And B, what can we do to attract people to them more?
I think that in terms of what are the fastest growing industries, what are the most exciting industries, you know, I do think advanced manufacturing. So manufacturing, very complicated thing. Manufacturing airplanes is really important. Manufacturing drones at some point in the future, I think, will become a huge, huge industry. Yeah. We would love if we had a really impressive semiconductor industry. But, you know, manufacturing cars and trucks and making it, you know, manufacturing the basic building blocks for houses and offices and buildings, things like that, and just manufacturing basic electronics, consumer electronics that we have, and machine tools and things like that, all of those are really, really, really important. And there's a kind of frustrating debate that you get in the UK where everybody talks about quote-unquote industrial policy. I don't think anybody really is in agreement when they talk about industrial policy. You know, sometimes industrial policy means we want to have a body that is trying to direct every business or most of the businesses in a region towards a particular sector. And we want to decide that, you know, the Northeast is going to be the car making sector and so on. Sometimes industrial policy means we want to, you know, do business rates, holiday. I don't think that would be a very good industrial policy, but you know, it's very vague. And often what people really mean is we care a lot about, manufacturing to some extent, but kind of more broadly, we care about growth outside of very high knowledge, software and creative based industries that you get in somewhere like London or finance. And to them, I would say, or kind of more broadly, I would say, look at the inputs and look at the really basic inputs to these things and look how much we have neglected those things. So energy is obviously a really, really big input for any kind of manufacturing. And again, I want to say I'm not a manufacturing fetishist. I don't think there's anything intrinsically good about making things compared to moving things around or compared to services or anything like that. But I do think that we are doing a lot to hold back the parts of the economy that could be making things. And as I say, the industrial price of energy tripling since 2003. Many people have said to me, I don't believe you because I've never heard that before. And that seems like such a big deal. That should be a bigger story. And my numbers are just from the Office for National Statistics. I've posted them many times online. There are other things like that. You know, we up until very recently had a corporation tax system that would tax you more if you invested in physical investment than if you bought pens and paper or weight or, you know, staff wages and things like that with the money. There are loads of things like that. You know, business rates will tax you more if you invest in new manufacturing equipment. So Tata Steel in Port Talbot, its business rates bill rose when it invested in new furnaces. You know, these are really, really basic things. And I don't think that, apart from the energy one, I don't think there's any kind of single thing we can do to the tax code or anything like that that will just, you know, transform the country. But I do think there are loads of things that are just getting the basics right. And it's this theme of getting the basics right before we think about the more sophisticated, maybe more exciting and sexy kinds of approaches that I think we're not doing enough of.
Why do you think we don't care about economic growth as much as we did?
It's a really, really tough question that I basically haven't got a good answer to. I think that there were a couple of papers that came out recently that looked at zero-sum thinking. And, you know, this is the idea that for you to benefit, somebody else has to lose out. And they looked at how many people agree with this and what age groups in lots of different countries. And they found that, surprisingly, kind of older people tended to be more positive-sum in their thinking. And it coincided with age groups that had experienced a lot of growth when they were younger. And so there is this hypothesis, and it's just speculation, that if you experience a lot of growth when you're young, you become used to the idea that things can get better overall, like everybody can get better off at the same time, rather than, well, we need this group to do better, so this group has to do worse. And that then becomes, I think, a virtuous or a vicious cycle, where if you have a sort of positive sum mindset in terms of the economy, then you might be more open to policies that on their face don't look like they're going to benefit you directly, but you realize, or you maybe believe, that later on they will benefit you indirectly. You know, I don't think that what I'm talking about is anything to do with greed. I don't think it's to do with being, you know, anti-business or anything like that. And, you know, it's often not business we should be thinking of, it's consumers that we should be thinking of, you know, and often people don't make that distinction when they should. But I worry that countries can get into a kind of vicious cycle where they can only really see things as being static, the overall pie as being static. And if that's true, and it is a zero-sum game, or if they believe that it is a zero-sum game, then it doesn't make sense to think about growth. It makes sense to think about, like, what do we do with the stuff that we've already got? Then the kind of maybe more charitable, that's a fairly uncharitable view that sort of thinks that effectively people haven't seen growth, and so they're becoming more, I guess, beggar thy neighbor or something. The other possibility is that there are loads of really, really big challenges that we face that are either not related to growth or are diametrically opposed to growth. So, you know, climate change and net zero, I think they're really, really, really important. They're I wouldn't say they're quite existential, but they're really, really, really important. And for many people, they are existential. You know, many, many people, their lives and their livelihoods do depend on us solving this problem. And I don't believe that fixing that is a free lunch. You know, I think it's going to be costly. And so it's very rational and very reasonable to want to sacrifice some degree of economic growth to solve those problems. I'm just not sure that we've realized that to a large extent, economic growth will make it easier to solve those problems as well.
So I worry particularly about what you've just said, largely because I agree with a lot of it in terms of if you're surrounded by kind of a growing economy, ambitious people, then it just begins to sort of like, it creates its own sort of flywheel and kind of dynamic. And particularly with what you said right at the beginning of basically what the last 15 years has seen in the UK since the financial crash, and we were particularly reliant on FS, so we were hit harder perhaps by a lot of other countries, that we have a generation now of sort of elder millennials and so on that aren't as ambitious as they could be. And I think it's worrying. I know you've spent quite a lot of time in San Francisco in particular, but like, how do we get more ambition into the UK?
In some ways, I'm a kind of Marxist in that I think that economic fundamentals are really, really powerful. You know, I don't think that they're everything. I think that culture and mindset and things like that are really important. But I think that if you manage to get housing to be less of a thing that is something you dream about and more of a thing that is a guarantee, not guaranteed by the state, but guaranteed in the same way that food is or your clothes are, because you can afford it. And most people on anything but very, very lowest incomes can expect that they will be able to live in a house that they like and that gives them what they need in life. I think if we were able to do that, then people would feel much less economically insecure and would be much, much more willing to take risks in other areas. You know, I think that the flip side of what you've said is that there are loads of really entrepreneurial people, especially young people, who are really interested in and kind of inspired by the huge amount of innovation and entrepreneurship that we've had over the last 20 years. Some of it in the UK, I would say more of it in the US, but you know, still some in the UK. And they see that and they are really, really interested in it. You know, they every single person under the age of 30 knows who Steve Jobs is. Every single person knows who Elon Musk is. I would wager that people are better at telling you about what those people have done in their lives than the previous generation could have told you about, you know, Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or, you know, the last generation of kind of entrepreneurs and investors and people like that. So I think there's a sort of combination of economic insecurity, which means that it's actually practically really difficult to take those risks because you may not have a place to live if you do and you fail, but also a kind of recognition that there are things out there. And this is a time where in many ways it's easier than ever to have an idea and to bring the idea out into the world. And so I'm a real believer. You know, my kind of mantra is this idea of the housing theory of everything, which is that, you know, housing shortages we think of as being a cost of living problem, which they are, but they're also, because they determine where people can actually be, and because people are such an important resource, a quote-unquote resource, housing shortages mean you get less innovation because people can't be around other people who they might come up with ideas with. You get less productivity because people can't move to high productivity places like Oxford or Cambridge. You get fewer children being born because it's too expensive or because you don't have the security that you want to bring a child into the world. And I believe that if we could get more housing in particular built, infrastructure and energy is related, but I think housing is the really fundamental one, then we would unlock a lot of entrepreneurship and unlock a lot of innovation. And so that's why I'm kind of an optimist despite where we are. And even on this point about zero sum mindset, I used to think that the way to get more housing built was to persuade 51% of the country that we need a lot of houses and to kind of swallow their opposition and, you know, let's have a referendum or a big election. I now think that actually the solution is what you might think of as like pump priming, where you come up with hopefully quite ingenious ways of getting houses built.
Yeah, and that's it, right, as well. It's like it's lots of these things are it's incremental pieces that you're doing. There are no sort of silver bullets. And some great, you know, politicians come up with great statements and so on and grand visions, whereas actually like a lot of this is, you know, nuts and bolts, the plumbing of the economy and trying to kind of like improve it.
The basics, you know, it's in many ways a kind of appealing thing to think we actually just get it's almost like we're taking an hour-long detour on our way to work every day, and as soon as we realize we're doing that, we can fix it, you know. In many ways, the problem is so big and so significant that it really doesn't require 100,000 reviews and panels and experts and things like that. It requires clear, serious thinking about how you solve the problem and lots of micro approaches to solving the problem. But get more houses built, and I think a lot of problems get solved after that.
And let's be positive and like going forward. But somebody that you've done a lot of work with, Tyler Cowen, one of his great quotes I think is really striking is that the southeast of England is genuinely one of the few places in the world where you can birth and execute a world-changing idea. Why do you think that is?
Well, historically, I think the UK, and actually, I mean, now I'm really just talking about my own personal, you know, feelings here, but I think the UK is a really unusually kind of pro-argument and pro-dissent place. I think that while, of course, as everywhere does, there can be tendencies towards conformism and against people who have like unpopular and weird opinions. In my experience, and the reason I moved here, is that I really, really think that within all, you know, it's true of Wales and Scotland, and I think it's true to some extent of Ireland, although personally, it's actually one of the reasons that I preferred living in London to living in Ireland, is that I think that English British culture is really, really positive about friendly, constructive argument or debate. And I think that itself is really, really conducive to innovation. And you know, the fact that the Industrial Revolution happened here and didn't just happen because, you know, we discovered coal before everybody else did. You know, we've known about coal for a really, really long time. The Romans knew about coal. It was that we actually came up with uses for it that were really, really valuable. Yeah. And we came up with interesting improvements to things across the board. You know, there's a historian, a group of historians doing a lot of work on this. My favorite is a guy called Anton Howes, who's based in Edinburgh. And he has a book. He's a brilliant guy, and he has a book coming out, but he writes a great Substack. And what he has pointed out is that it's kind of from the 1650s or from the sort of middle of the 17th century on, you know, much earlier, about 100 years earlier than we usually think the Industrial Revolution began here, that we started to see improvements in things like musical instruments, watches, all sorts of gadgets that nobody would say, oh, you know, the Industrial Revolution happened because we got better watches or because we got better musical instruments. But the fact that these began to improve and become cheaper and more accessible is a sign that there was a sort of sense of innovation across the whole, across lots and lots of domains. And I think it's that sense of improvement, that kind of improving mindset that took hold around that time. The Royal Society was founded. The Royal Society of the Arts was founded a little bit after that. You know, you had this sense that we can actually make the world better by experimenting and by trying things out. And I think that that is something that we've held on to in England. And my hope and my dream is that it catches fire again here. Because you know, again, just talking about my own personal feelings, you know, even though incomes in the UK are much lower than they are in the US, I think in many other ways, our standard of living is higher. You know, crime rates are lower. Our cities, I think, are a lot more livable. It's a lot easier to get around. New York City is the only, and maybe Boston to some extent, but New York is really the only city in America where you don't really have to own a car to be able to do things. You can definitely do that in London. And there are other cities in the UK where it's sort of feasible to not own a car. And there are loads of other things. You know, the countryside here is beautiful. The food, I think, is amazing in the UK. It has a terrible reputation internationally, but it's totally undeserved. So there are loads of really great, I think, kind of fundamentals that the UK has. It's just that we're not very rich, and housing is really expensive, and energy is really expensive.
Yeah.
And that's why I keep coming back to these, as if we could solve them, I think it's very, very possible that we could make the UK by far the best place in the world to live.
And we'll come on to particularly talking about it. We should say Anton Howes's Substack is Age of Invention, which we'll list in show notes and below.
It's so good. Yeah. It's so good.
Like the economic history, I find, of cities and how they're going to be is fascinating. And let's talk about what you're doing to try and inject some of this ambition and conversation into it. So you sort of started first part of your career at the Adam Smith Institute, kind of traditional think tank and so on. And then at the start of the pandemic, you set up an online magazine.
Yeah, and soon to be a real magazine. So we're actually, this week, we've been signing off on the kind of design of the physical edition.
Oh, great.
So it's called Works in Progress, and we call it a magazine of new and underrated ideas to improve the world. And we focus on science, technology, and economics. And really what we originally set out to do, my friend Saloni and I, and then also two other friends, Ben and Nick, was find a place or create a place online that you could write for if you had an interesting idea. It doesn't necessarily have to be the finished thought, hence the kind of works in progress, but that gives a sort of insight to people who are not in your field about things that you think are interesting or relevant to them from what you're doing. You know, I was really struck by, you know, I'm in a lot of group chats with people who are much more knowledgeable and smart than I am, and I'm really struck by how much interesting ideas, how many interesting ideas, how much interesting insight they have that never sees the light of day. And one of the hopes that we had for Works in Progress was we could say to somebody like Anton, let's say, you know, hey, you know that really interesting debate you've just been having with somebody about innovation prizes? And, you know, did the Longitude prizes actually help that much, or did they work? Or, you know, what are the lessons from the Longitude prizes for encouraging innovation? You know, why don't you write that up as a 2,000 or 3,000 word essay, and then everybody can read it, and hopefully many more people will have their own inputs and their own ideas. And so we started it, and it mainly began, well, it began entirely as a hobby. You know, we never really expected it to become a thing that we'd spend our full time on. But I'm really, really proud of it, and I'm really proud of what we did at the beginning as well, because we tried to not compromise in terms of we want it to be readable, but we don't want it to be dumbed down, and we want, you know, we want it to be something that is provocative to an expert, or something that will be interesting to an expert in the field but accessible to a non-expert. And I think, you know, we haven't always got it right. I think that there is a really big appetite for, as the world of podcasting has shown as well, there's a really big appetite for much deeper explorations of ideas than most mainstream or most traditional media outlets are able to give them.
I mean, it's exactly the same reason I set up Jimmy's Jobs. One of the things that I think is amazing about the modern world is like the internet and it acting like the printing press in terms of content that's being created and so on. But how did you first come across these writers? Can you remember sort of that far back, 15 years ago? But like, how can we get people that, because there are some amazing pieces on there that, you know, you either find very interesting or sort of not very interesting at all. But yeah, that sort of those content streams for people's information flows, I just think it can be such a kind of like accelerant in somebody's early career if they can find them, but it can be quite difficult to know what you're looking for when you're 18.
Yeah, totally. So I grew up in Cork in Ireland. I read a lot of books when I was young and a teenager. And then when I got my first laptop, you know, I got a job at McDonald's, saved up initially because I wanted to get an iPod. I'm deaf in one ear, and I was really into the Beatles at the time, and a lot of the Beatles' early stereo is really badly done. So the instruments go in one ear and the vocals go in the other. And I remember, you know, listening with both headphones put up next to my left ear so I could hear a song. And the iPod came along, and you could rip the songs from your CDs in mono. So it meant that I was able to, this is before they did the mono re-release of all the Beatles albums. So it was totally transformational to me as a music fan. And I bought the iPod and then realized we didn't have a computer that could run it. So then I had to save up and get a laptop. And this is all, you know, first job stuff, which was great. And I actually really enjoyed. But having got the laptop, it really, really opened my world to the kind of early 2000s-ish internet. So the blogosphere, you know, I remember like Andrew Sullivan, Instapundit, you know, these sorts of people who are still going and still around. But, you know, at the time, it was a very different kind of world. And I was really interested in, you know, US politics and that kind of thing when I was 14, 15. And became more and more, you know, I've never, even though I am really, really, really interested in ideas, I've never been totally comfortable with like the libertarian ideology, or I know that if people kind of follow me, they'll probably look at me as a sort of libertarian, but I've always been kind of slightly, oh, I'm not so sure about that one, or I'm not so sure about that idea. Labels are helpful, so I don't deny any label, but found it really interesting to kind of discover, oh right, there is a name for this for this worldview, and oh, there is a name for this worldview, and like, oh, I think I'll take a little bit from that and a little bit from that, happy to call myself one or the other, blah blah blah. Having read a lot of blogs, and I actually started my own when I was a student that I don't think anybody read, got into Twitter was I got into Twitter in 2007, so I was one of the early adopters, and really, really found that there were a lot of other people out there who were more advanced than I was, who had thought a lot more than I was, than I had, but were pretty open to chatting to a fairly young, kind of silly guy like me. And so I ended up just doing a lot of reading, emailing a lot of people, asking questions and things like that. And I'm a real generalist. You know, I really don't consider myself to be an expert on anything. But I do, the one thing maybe I'm an expert in is seeing smart people and interesting people and trying to get them to do things for me. You know, it's like trying to get them to write for me or trying to get them to speak for me or whatever. And, you know, if I was on a football team, I'd probably be like a scout or something like that. Don't think I'd be the manager. I don't think I'd be the striker, but I think I could be a really good scout. And so just over the years, even when I was at the ASI, the real skill that I had was finding young, kind of misemployed people who, you know, should be, you know, people who now are really important leading, you know, a really good example, a guy called Sam Dimitriou, who is doing, I think, some of the most important policy research in the UK on infrastructure costs and, you know, really diving into why does it cost so much to build trams in Leeds compared to building them in, you know, Bologna or somewhere like that.
Yeah.
And when I met him, he was doing events at another think tank. He was, you know, just out of college. I thought, my God, this guy is smart. Let's get him. And that's kind of always been my approach. Just get really good people like that.
Where, and of course, in the Works in Progress history, you are Online Magazine, going to be in print soon, which is very exciting, but you were acquired by Stripe, which is largely seen as a payments company. What was the story behind that and how did that come to be?
Yeah, so we set up Works in Progress at the beginning of 2020 and we launched our first issue in 2020, around August. We then ran it as a hobby for until kind of mid-2021. And then around sort of June, July, I got an email from somebody who worked at Stripe, which I was aware of, for reasons that I'll go into in a minute, saying, you know, would you be interested in chatting about, you know, joining forces? And my first reaction was no.
I kind of thought, well, I don't really want to have a logo on our site, and I'm pretty comfortable doing this the way we're doing it. And I thought, I was thinking of it as a sort of sponsorship type thing, which we weren't interested in. Long story short, we ended up agreeing. We joined Works in Progress, became part of Stripe, and the four of us became employees of Stripe. And I now work at Stripe, running Works in Progress, and also something called Stripe Press. And Stripe Press is quite well known in the US, especially among the kind of tech world, but less well known in the UK right now. And I hope that that will change. And Stripe Press is a book publishing imprint that Stripe set up in 2017. And it produces books, some of which are aimed at developers or founders. So basically the people who might use Stripe. And they're very, very tactical. They're very focused on, you know, how do you do sales? How do you, how do you scale up your business? And I think that the benefit of those to Stripe is pretty straightforward, that it's really good if your users have the tools that can help them grow their businesses. You know, because Stripe is a kind of financial infrastructure company, it wants its users to succeed, and it wants its users to grow and to prosper. It wants the internet economy to grow and to prosper. But it also does some books on economic growth. And, you know, my favorite Stripe Press book is called Where's My Flying Car? And it's quite a grumpy book, but I really recommend it. It's by an engineer, and it's partly literally about, you know, why don't we have flying cars, and like the physics and engineering of flying cars. And, you know, there is actually a pretty interesting history of flying cars. They're not just an imagination thing. There have been things that are a bit like flying cars existed. But then also about more general kind of obstacles to technological progress, using the flying car as a sort of microcosm. And in that case, about the importance of energy and cheap energy as a sort of factor of economic growth. And so why did Stripe publish those books? I think partly it's because there's a very macro way in which ideas drive Stripe's interest, as well as the you know, a book for a founder or a developer can be really, really great for Stripe if it helps them scale their company.
Yeah.
A book that helps people understand how to make society or the kind of global economy advance as a whole is also a really, really great thing for Stripe, because a growing economy is a great thing for the company. But it's also, my colleague used a really great example the other day. You know, Nike is talking about running, you know, their ads are much more about the lifestyle and the culture of running than they are just about wearing Nike shoes.
Yeah.
Because they think that the more there is a sort of general feeling of running and exercise and sports as being like a really important part of people's lives, that Nike will kind of rise with that. Nike will be a boat that rises with that tide.
Yeah.
I know everybody would be really annoyed that I say Nike rather than Nike. Everybody hates me for saying this, for saying Nike. In a way, that's true of Stripe as well. You know, the more the world is thinking about solutions to problems and growth and progress, scientific progress, technological progress, the more Stripe rises with that boat. And I think, you know, it's not surprising to see it do it when you think about it like that. And, you know, I think you may begin to see other big companies like that think in the same way, because, you know, ideas are as much a factor in growing the internet economy as getting your payments working well, or, you know, getting your product working really well. And so when you have that in mind, the Works in Progress kind of addition makes a lot more sense, I think. You know, and when you think of it as a fairly low cost bet on really big ideas, then I think it makes sense. And to give a really narrow example, I often sort of say to people, what's the one thing from a policy point of view that would do more than any other change to benefit Stripe? And apart from the things to do with the financial regulation and stuff like that, which I don't know about and definitely can't talk about, I would say it is getting more houses built in the San Francisco Bay Area, number one, and getting more houses built in London, number two, and getting more houses built in New York, number three, and Dublin, number four. The ordering might be slightly different. There may be some other cities in there, but getting houses built in those areas would allow so many more people to move there, so many more companies to be set up, so many more great engineers to be hired by companies as they're starting. Hopefully some of them use Stripe. And I think that would lead to a big, big, big increase in innovation and startup formation and entrepreneurship. And that's a good thing for Stripe. So it's a kind of, it's a weird thing to think about a company that does payments and other financial infrastructure thinking about ideas in that way. But in some ways, I think it's weird that we don't see more of it from other places.
And what would your advice be to people that are thinking of starting an online magazine, have started one? You know, what would your advice be on that?
My big advice would be start a Substack. I think Substack is one of the most impressive and exciting companies. You know, I think podcasting for most people has a lot of overheads and can be, you know, it's a lot of work. Yeah. To make a good podcast requires a lot more than I think you think. As a listener, you kind of think, oh, well,
agreed.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I think that there are, you know, a really good podcast is an amazing thing, but it's much harder to do than a really good Substack, which ultimately one really good person with focus and clarity of what they want to do can do. And I think that, you know, try to find the thing that you are able to write a lot about. Try to find a niche. You know, I think that kind of general, and I say this as somebody who has a very general Substack. You know, I do everything from like product recommendations to energy prices and things like that. But I subscribe to lots of Substacks that are quite niche. And, you know, when I see a Substack that I think, okay, I just need to read that Substack and I will know everything I need to know about construction physics or the history of the English Industrial Revolution or whatever it might be. That's a really good way of building a kind of personal brand or a personal profile, which I think if you want to get into the world of publishing or ideas, you know, that kind of personal profile is really, really valuable. And, you know, maybe 5 years ago or even 3 years ago, I would have said like Twitter is probably your biggest tool. I think Twitter is still really important. Like Twitter is ultimately where a lot of the discussions happen, like it or not. But a lot of the changes that have happened to the Twitter algorithm mean that you can't rely on it. You know, it's much harder to enter the Twitter now than it used to be. So I think Substack really, really, really is, I think, and I also suspect we are way, way before the peak of Substack. You know, it may not be literally Substack the company, but I think that the amount of depth that you can get in a good newsletter is really, it's better than the golden age of blogging.
So I agree with that. I've got a very specific question on. Do you think there was, this is quite a good way to round it, bringing it back to Britain. I wonder if Substack can really work in the UK for two reasons. One is that we are used to getting free media via the BBC. Mm-hmm. So people paying micropayments is just something that we're not accustomed to. Mm-hmm. And that actually therefore makes it quite a big barrier. And also aligned with that is that we don't have a tipping culture. Mm. So again, that sort of paying $4 or $5 for an article or several articles a month just does not enter people's kind of logical thought processes for this.
Yeah, I think that's a very strong point as far as Substack as a profession goes. I'm thinking of it more as a kind of complement to something else, whether you're a journalist or an academic or an engineer or anything. You know, you could do anything and have this side interest or side knowledge or just thing that you want to really get into. There are some exceptions. You know, Ed West, I think, is a really good example. Yes. Who's a, you know, I don't agree with him on a lot of things, but he's a great, great, great writer. I always make a point of reading his Substack. And he's very English. I know that he has a lot of subscribers from outside the UK, but he doesn't really compromise on when he wants to write about England, which is a lot, he does, or write about the UK, he does. And so I think that it is, and he does that as a living. And I personally, as a kind of person who's read a lot of his stuff over the years, I think that his Substack is like the best he's ever been. You know, I, and Anton, for example, does a bit of, you know, Anton's Substack is, you can get it for free or you can get the deluxe version. And he is also writing a book. He does other research. He's in many ways a kind of freelance historian, which is quite cool. And you know, the Substack, I think, is doing very well and is very healthy, but it isn't the only thing he does.
Yeah.
And so I think there are lots of kind of hybrid ways of working with it. But you know, so often, especially when I worked in think tanks, kind of younger people would ask, like, how did you get into this? And the first thing to say is, like, the pay is not very good, certainly in center-right think tanks. I don't think it's that great on the other side either, but the pay is not that good, so don't necessarily plan on this as, like, a career path. But also, the more you can have a kind of thing that you are bringing to the table, as, like, I know more than anybody about X, or maybe I don't know more than anybody about X, but I do know more than anybody about X plus Y two subject, the intersection of two different subjects. The more you can set yourself apart, and in some ways, Works in Progress is a big competitor of Substacks. Like we use it for our newsletter and we send out some Substacks, but not everybody will have a newsletter in them. Not everybody will have something that they can write about 12 to 52 times a year, or even more than that, because that's a hell of a lot of work.
And
they might have a really, really good single item. They might have one really good essay in them. And so Works in Progress, I think, hopefully both competes with and complements the Substack approach, because we can be a sort of platform, as any media brand is. You hopefully know what you're getting with Works in Progress, and then you can read a person you maybe didn't know about before. Maybe they wouldn't have done a Substack, but you'll really appreciate the work and you'll learn a lot from it. And hopefully they'll appreciate being able to put their ideas out there.
Totally. Sam, thanks so much for coming on Jimmy's Jobs of the Future. It's been amazing to hear about your story and all you're doing with Works in Progress. I think it's really exciting and really interesting.
Thanks. It's been great being here.